And we're holding here on page Tess in Yerushalmi Shkolim, Ois Chof Vav. So we learned last time that there are the Mishnah had mentioned that when you have 13 different places, you're supposed to bow down as you go around the Beis Hamikdash complex. So Rabbi Gamliel's and Rabbi Chanina Sgan HaKohanim's family would bow a 14th time by the Lishkas Dir HaEtzim, by the chamber where they kept the wood, because they had a Masoda in their families that that's where the Aron was hidden at the end of the first Beis Hamikdash. So now the Gemara talks about the different opinions on that topic. What happened to the Aron at the time? What happened to the Aron before or at the time of the Churban? We learned about it in Bavli Yuma as well a while back. So the Yerushalmi says, Toni b'shem Rabbi Eliezer. We learn a brisa in the name of Rabbi Eliezer. Aron goli mohem lebavel, that he says the Aron was not hidden underground, but rather it was taken with the Jewish people in Golos to Bavel. Actually, there were, when we learned it in Yuma, there were actually Mefarshim there who wanted to say that maybe he doesn't disagree that it was hidden underground, but he would say that the Bavliim nevertheless were able to find it and bring it up from there and take him to Golus. Matam, where does Rabbi Eliezer get that from? Mishum Shenemar, because you have 100 years earlier, you have the story in Sefer Melachim and also repeated in Yeshaya and more briefly in Divrei Hayamim, where after you had the Nisim that happened to Chizkiyahu, you had Sancheiriv's army was destroyed, so Chizkiyahu himself was deathly ill, and Hashem was healed in Mederach Nes and moved the sun backwards, etc., etc. So then messengers from the king of Babel at that time, Merodach Baladan, came to visit him because Merodach Baladan was very impressed by all of this, and Chizkiyahu showed them all his treasures and made it seem as though it was all his doing, as though it was all his schus, which so then Yeshaya comes to him with a very sharply worded nevuah, very harsh nevuah, saying that what's going to happen because of that, eventually all of these treasures are going to be taken by the king of Bavel and by the descendant, by a future king of Bavel, and even your own descendants, including Hanan, Daniel, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, are going to be taken to serve in the king's palace over there. The expression that Yeshaya, by the way, the Malbim points out over there on the Psukim, it is Midah Keneged Midah, but it's also, he says, it's a kind of a practical matter also. Until then, the kings of Babel had no idea how much wealth there is in Eretz Yisrael. Now, all of a sudden, they discovered it. It's like they filed that information away to know for the future, and that's what made them, and that's what gave them the idea to go and try to get it in the first place. Anyway, so the Pasuk says, Lo yuvosu dover oman Hashem. Hashem says, all of these treasures are going to be taken. There won't be anything left, says Hashem. So now, on the surface, the Pasuk is talking about all of Chizkiyahu's treasures. But since the Pasuk already says, Kol Hashem b'vesecha v'asha otzru v'vesecha, the earlier part of the Pasuk is everything that's in your palace and everything that your ancestors stored up. So that means all the royal treasures. So we have to understand that Lo yuvosu dover is referring to something beyond that, specifically the in dover elashad dibris l'soichai. The word dover then refers to the Aron in which the dibris, in which the luchas with the aseres hadibris are located. V'cheinu Omer, and Rabbi Eliezer continues. You see also from the Pesukim in Divrei Hayamim about what happened at the time of the Churban. V'leshuvas Hashana, the Pesuk describes at the turn of the year, this is talking about after Yehoyakim had been killed or died, whatever, there are different opinions what happened to him exactly. In any case, his son Yechonia was appointed as king after him. We're actually going to learn a little bit about that story when we get to Yerushalmi Tainis. So shortly after that, Nebuchadnezzar came back. He sent Nebuzaradan, his general. Shalach HaMelech Nebuchadnezzar, he sent his general Nebuzaradan, Vayivi'ehu Bavela, and he brought Yehoyachin to Bavel im klei chemdas beis Hashem, together with the desirable kalim of the house of Hashem. So Ezo klei chemdas beis Hashem, what does that mean? Klei chemdas zeha oren. So Rabbi Eliezer says that refers to the oren, so we see that the oren was taken to Bavel. We actually find, first of all, as far as Chizkiyahu, the Medrash mentions that actually when Chizkiyahu showed him all the treasures in his palace and in the Beis Hamikdash and all, to the messengers of Merodach Baladan, he even had the Oren opened up and showed them the Luchas. And showed them, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, that this is what goes with us to battle. The Oren goes with us to battle, and that's how we win. So therefore, so now the Eibishter is saying, as a result of that, that same Oren, says Rabbi Eliezer, that's how he understands the Psukim, is going to be taken to Bavel. As far as calling it Klei Chemdas Beis Hashem, an interesting other example of that is you find a couple of hundred years before Chizkiyahu, you find Achav, who was a total Rosha, but nevertheless, you find at one point Ben-Hadad, the king of Aram, who was fighting against him, tells him at one point, everything you have to agree that I will say that I'm going to send my soldiers, and they're going to search through your entire palace and take whatever they want, because you're weak and you can't fight against me, and therefore you're going to have to live with that. And I'm even going to take Ben-Hadad uses the expression that I'm going to take your most precious things, called machma deinecha. And the Gemara explains in Sanhedrin that that actually refers to the king's Sefer Torah. And at that, Achav put his foot down. He talked it over with the Zekanim and put his foot down and said, Ben-Hadad, I'm willing to give away anything else, but not my kingly Sefer Torah. So we see that that's called Machma Deinecha. And so it's the same word over here as Chemdas Beis Hashem, the same Shurdash. So that's one opinion. On the other hand, Tani Rabbi Yehuda Bar Eloi, Rabbi Shimon Lakishomer, Bimakoy Mohaya Ha'orun Gonners. Note, the Orun was hidden underneath where it's supposed to be, meaning under the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, Vayarichu Abadim Gomer, the poles of the Orun were extended, and the Pasuk describes, as we've learned before, how they were pushing out against the Poroiches. You had in the first Beis Mikdash, there was a wall between the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKadoshim, but then there was a doorway in the middle of that wall, and that doorway was covered with a Poroiches, and the Pesukim describe how the Badim pushed out against it, so that you could see from the outside, to when you were standing in the Heichel, you would see two bumps in a couple of other places. The Gemara compares it to the woman's breasts under her shirt. And the point of Ben Shaddai Yolin, Hashem would dwell over there, Shekhinah would dwell over there between the two Badim, as if, so to speak, like a husband and wife being intimate. The point is that the Pasuk says that the poles were extended by Yiyusham Ad HaYemazen, and they were there until this very day. And the Gemara explains it, the Bavli explains in Yoma, when it says Ad HaYemazen, means literally until this very day. It means anytime you read the Pasuk, it's going to say Ad HaYemazen. So therefore, it must mean that the Orin is still there, and where would it be then? Under the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So HaKosef points out Rabbi Eliezer is not bothered by that, because he would say, fine, what the Pasuk means is the poles of the Aron are still just as long as they were when they brought it into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, but it doesn't mean that it's still located in the same place. Okay, so you have three different opinions, in short, what happened to the Aron. It was hidden under the Kodesh HaKadoshim, it was hidden under the Lishkas Dira Eitzim, or it was taken to Bavel. Now, how many Aronis were there? So Tony Rabbi Yehuda ben Eloi, Beis Aronis Hoyu Mistura by Midbar. The Jewish people had with them two Aronis in the desert. There was one that the Torah, which may mean a Sefer Torah, or it may mean the Luchos, which contain the whole Torah in capsule form. That one was placed in the Oyel Moed. That was the one that had the whole Luchos in it. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, you find by the Ma'apilim after the Cheta Meraglim, when Moshe tells them, this generation, you guys are not going into Eretz Yisrael, only your children were. So afterwards, you have everybody was very sad, and everybody did tshuva at that point, as the Alter Rebbe explains in Tanya and Perek Chof Tes. Moshe had yelled against their Yetzirah to the point where now the Yetzirah is broken, and now they have their Amunah and the Ebishta after all, and they say, let's go and try to conquer Eretz Yisrael. And Moshe tells them, now it's too late, it's not going to work. And they tried anyway, and the Pasuk says, V'aroin b'ris Hashem u'Moshe lo'y moshu mikerav ha'machne. The Oron and Moshe did not leave the Machne. And they went and they were defeated. So the implication is, in other words, that there would be an Oron that normally would go with them. Now, though, the way Rabbi Yehuda ben Eloi is saying it is that this is actually not the one that would regularly go with them. He's going to go on to say that only the one with the broken luchos would go with them. So what's the proof from this? And in fact, there are Mephoshim who say that maybe you should take out that proof from the Pasuk, because what kind of proof is that? The fact is, the Oren that stays in the Machna, the one that we're talking about over here, that has the whole Luchas, wasn't going to go out with them to war anyway. On the other hand, there are Mephoshim who defend it, and they say that the idea would be, in other words, they should have realized, no Oren is going with us, how are we going to be successful? So that shows that at least there is an Oren that's going with them, even if it's not this particular one. Anyway, the Hasheni show you Shivri Luchas Nisunin Besoichai. Then there was the second one that the broken Luchas were placed in it. Hayan Nichnes Vyotze Imahen. That one would go in and out with them to war. Pa'omim Hayan Misra Imahen Bamochama. And sometimes it would be seen with them in the war. Now, again, there are different Girsois over here, whether those words belong over here. If we're saying it went with them to war, of course it's seen with them in war. Why would it even need to say that? So a number of Mephoshim take out the line, but then there are others that defend it and say that, no, what it means is, in other words, when they went to war, sometimes they would actually have it near the soldiers, and sometimes they would have it behind the lines. So therefore, sometimes you could actually see it. The soldiers are going to war, and you would see that the Aron is being carried with them. And sometimes it would be someplace there in the Machne, but not right there, visible with the soldiers.
Where it says that he took it with him.
So we're going to talk about those psukim. We're going to talk about those psukim now in the Gemara. But now, one thing is, this whole thing that the Yerushalmi is saying over here, that there were two Aronis, is not universally agreed to. The Bavli, when it talks about the Aron in Bava Basra, instead says that the Luchas and the Shivrei Luchas were all in one Aron.
How do they fit?
So, because the Gemara explains over there, so first of all, you have different opinions how big the luchos were anyway. The Bavli says that the luchos were 6 tefachim by 6 tefachim, the faces of them, and then the thickness was 3 tefachim. The Yerushalmi elsewhere seems to say, or at least it can be understood as saying, that each one was actually 6 by 3 by 3. An interesting point in that regard is like this: you have the luchos. We know that Eber made a big point about the luchos have to be drawn not with rounded tops as they sometimes do in the Velt. But you find some Lubavitcher publications like Talks and Tales, for example, that have them drawn square, and then you have other ones that have them drawn rectangular. And very often on our very own parochus over here, we have them drawn rectangular. Those fine, because those can reflect the different opinions of the Bavli versus the Yerushalmi, whether they were fronts of them were square or rectangular. In any case, according to the Bavli, it comes out that what you would have is you would have the broken luchos, and then on top of them, you would have the whole luchos. Given that the luchos were only 3 tefachim thick, so there would be room for 3 tefachim plus another 3 tefachim on top. Fine, the height of the Aron, you have different opinions, whether the Aron is measured, whether the amos of the Aron are 5 or 6 tefachim, but even according to Rabbi Yehuda, that the amos of the Aron, the amma and a half height of the Aron is 7.5 tefachim, that still gives you plenty of room for 6 tefachim for the whole luchos and the broken luchos. According to the Yerushalmi, it may actually be that the whole luchos. Well, you see, the Yerushalmi over here was saying, at least according to Rabbi Yehuda ben Eloi, that which is Stam Rabbi Yehuda in Shas, that according to him, you have the whole luchos and the broken luchos were in different aronis. But it might also be, given what the Yerushalmi says as far as the size of them, if we understand it to be saying they were 6 by 3, they might have been placed one next to the other. So you have the broken luchos and then next to them the whole luchos, and you wouldn't need and you would rather than having one on top of the other.
There's an opinion that there was also a madaf.
There's also an opinion in the Gemara in the Bavli that the Yerushalmi also mentions the whole thing over here about that there was a shelf outside it for the Sefer Torah. Right, that has to do with the opinion. According to Rabbi Yehuda, there's no room inside the Aron for the Sefer Torah next to the Luchos, because according to him, the whole length of the Aron is only 12 and a half tefachim, and 12 tefachim are taken up by the Luchos. So yeah, according to him, the Sefer Torah was on the outside on a shelf, and then afterwards on top of the box of golden ornaments that the Plishtim gave after they captured the Aron. Yeah, and then the Gemara discusses that whole point in Bava Basra, in the Bavli discusses in Bava Basra, yeah. Anyway, the point is, this idea over here that was saying that there were two Aronis, and according to that, one of them was made by Moshe, because you have in Parashat Ekev, where Hashem tells him, V'asisa l'cha Aron eitz, and the other one that was made by Bezalel, according to the Yerushalmi over here, there were two different Aronis, whereas according to the Bavli, there was only the one Aron. So in other words, there would be the one that Moshe temporarily made to hold the Luchos until the Mishkan was built, and afterwards that was replaced by Bezalel's Aron, and according to that, Moshe's Aron was never used again. So our Gemara is going according to the, is following the opinion that they still continued to have two Aronis. So that's the Gemara continues. Now the Chachamim disagree with Rabbi Yehuda ben Rabbi Eloi. They say, Aron Echad Hoya, there was in fact only the one Aron. And it never usually went with them to war. Pam achas yotzi b'mei Eli. Only one time did they take it out to war in the times of Eli, where in Sefer Shmuel it describes how at one point they went to fight against the Plishtim, and the Jewish people suffered a defeat on the first day of battle, and they decided, let's bring the Aron with us, that way Hashem the Schus will save us. And it was captured by the Venishba, and it was captured by the Plishtim. So the Gemara points out, now we have one of the psukim in that connection seems to support the opinion of the Chachamim that there was in fact only one Aron, and that it wasn't a usual thing for the Aron to be brought out to battle. Because you have the Plishtim, when they find out, the Psukim describe, when they brought the Aron to the Jewish camp, everybody was shouting for joy because they figured now for sure we're going to win. And the Psukim describe, the Plishtim heard all the shouting and they started asking and trying to investigate what's going on. And then they found out that the Aron has been brought. And the Pasuk says, they were saying to themselves, Oy lanu, woe to us. Mi yatzilenu miyad ho elekim ha'adirim ha'ela. Who is going to save us from this mighty God? So like all of a sudden, what do you mean Oilon, and they had an Oren and never been there before? So Milaya, Delechomen Miamehen, because this is something they had never seen. Now they had fought against the Jewish people many times before. The day before that, they had fought against them. But this is a chiddush that there should be the Oren over there. So therefore, so that supports the Chachamim's opinion that there's only the one Oren, and then this time was the first time that it was ever brought out to war. On the other hand, you also have a pasuk that supports Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Loi's opinion, because later on in Sefer Shmuel, you have yet another battle against the Plishtim, and in the course of the battle, at one point, Shaul wants to ask the Urim Betumim what to do, because you have a whole thing over there where the Plishtim are all thrown into confusion because Yehonasan and his arms bearer had gone in the and then by themselves and gone and started killing Plishtim in a very brave way, and now the Plishtim are all thrown into confusion, and Shaul sees it from the other side of the valley and is wondering what to do. So Vayomer Shmuel LaAchiyah. So Shmuel says to Achiyah, who was the Kohen Gadol at the time, Hagisha Aron HaLekim, bring close the Oren, because the Kohen who where is the Urim V'Tumim and is being asked from them, stands in front of the Oren. So what do you mean bring the Oren, as if to imply it's already here and all you need to do is bring it closer? V'alay Oren B'kiras Yorim Hava V'Chola. By that point, the Oren, so after the Plishtim had captured the Oren and they suffered terrible plagues and everything for it, and they were finally forced to return it, it was brought to the city of Beis Shemesh, and the Jewish people there, didn't the Jews in there in Beis Shemesh, didn't know how to treat it with respect, and a terrible plague broke out. So they asked the people of Kiryas Yorim, a nearby town, to take the Oren and keep it by them. It remained by them for 20 years until David brought it to Yerushalayim. So at this point, during Shaul's reign, it's located in Kiryas Yorim, and the battle was taking place. Kiryas Yorim is at the edge of Binyamin's territory. The battle was taking place in the city of Michmash, which is further east of Binyamin's territory, so they're nowhere near each other. They were a good few miles apart. So what do you mean, Hagisha Oren HaLekim? That suggests that the Oren was, in fact, already in the Machne, and all they have to do is bring it close to where Achiyah and Shaul are standing. So that supports Rabbi Yehuda's opinion that there was, in fact, an Oren that would regularly go with them to battle. There are, in fact, Mephoshim will kind of try to combine the two opinions and say that, I think Rashi mentions it in one place, that what it is with following Rabbi Huda's opinion, they usually would bring the Oren with the broken luchas to battle, like Rabbi Huda, Rabbi Loi says. They would never bring out the one, the gold-plated Oren that Bezalel made that had the whole luchas in it. The one time in the battle of Perek Dalet, they brought the one with the whole luchas in it, and that was then that ended up being captured by the Plishtim, and everything developed from there. Okay. The Gemara continues, Mishin Nignaz Oren, once the Oren was hidden away, Nignaz Imot Sinsenes Hamon, then also the jar of mon that was kept, we know that in Parshas B'Shalach, Hashem tells Moshe, fill up a jar with mon and keep it l'mishmeres l'dereseichem, as some as a keepsake for all time, that everybody should be able to see the bread that the Jewish people, the food that the Jewish people ate in the Midbar. Rashi brings over there a posuk, Rashi brings over there on the posuk, based on a medrash, that in particular in the times of Yirmiyah, there were Jewish people who were wondering, how can we possibly, you're telling us we should be learning Torah full time, how are we going to make a living? And so Hashem tells Yirmiyah, go show them that jar of mon and show them they were able to in the Midbar, and Hashem provided for them, and Hashem can do the same thing for you. So
open up the jar, was it translucent? Or
so there's different opinions about that. There's one, some Mephoshim learned that the jar was made out of earthenware, and in that case, yeah, he would have had to open it up. Others learned that it was made out of glass, and in that case, he could have showed them without opening it. Yeah. Either way, of course, that was a ness in itself, because usually, as we know, the mon would spoil and become wormy after a day, and here it remained fresh for hundreds of years. Anyway, so that was placed in front of the Oren. Hashem tells Moshe to tell Aaron to place it in front of the Oren, the Mishmeres, the Deres Eichem. So now, when the Oren was hidden away, then also this jar of mon was hidden with it, Utzloiches Shemen HaMishcha, as well as the jar of Shemen HaMishcha, the flask of Shemen HaMishcha. So from then on, by the way, that had implications in Halacha. From then on, they couldn't anoint like this. Until then, the Kohenim Gdolim was supposed to be anointed with the Shemen HaMishcha, and also kings if there was a machloikas about who's going to be the next king. From now on, they couldn't do that. From now on, the Kohenim Gdolim are instead Meruba Begodim. They became Kohenim Gdolim by wearing the eight clothes of the Kohen Gadol and doing the Avodah. Which means, in particular, you have one difference between them. The Mishnah tells us in Masechta Megillah, one difference between them is that when it describes in Parshas Vayikra, how you have a special korban that the Kohen Gadol brings if he makes a mistake in halacha and follows it. It was in Shlosha Prakim of Rambam last week. Then that's only done by a Kohen who was anointed with the Shemen HaMishcha, not Meruba Begodim. So therefore, in the end of the first base Mikdash, in the entire second base Mikdash, that korban wouldn't be able to be brought anymore. Anyway. So that's the Shemana Mishkah. Umakle shel Aaron procheo shkigah. Another thing that was hidden away with the Oren is Aaron's staff with the flowers and the almonds on it. We have in Parshas Korach where Hashem tells Moshe to take staffs from all the Nesim and put them in front of the Oren. And v'hoyo isha sheref chabe mateu yifrach. And Aaron's staff is the one that blossomed and produced almonds, and that showed once and for all that Shevet Levi and specifically Aaron are the ones chosen specially by Hashem for the avodah. So that was also in front of the Oren.
So that the blood for hundreds of
years. So it remained, the flowers and the almonds remained on it for hundreds of years. And again, it was in front of the Aron, and it was hidden away together with the Aron. The Bavli, by the way, learns that when it brings this in Yuma, it brings a bunch of Gzeira Shavas, how we know that each of these things had to be in front of the Aron, and how we know that each of them was hidden away with the Aron. Because by some of them, it says L'Bishmeres, and it says L'Dodes Seichem, and we have a series of Gzeira Shavas that teach us about all of them. And another thing, and also at that time, back at the time, again, before even Shaul became king, when Shiloh was destroyed and the Plishtim captured the Oren, and then they suffered all kinds of terrible plagues, and they were forced to return the Oren after 7 months. So the Psukim describe, they ask their priests and their magicians and whatnot, people who have a certain connection with Ruchnius, at least to their way of thinking, what should we do as far as returning the Oren? And they tell them, don't just return the Oren like that. Also give a gift to the Jewish God, and that way you'll show that you're sorry for what you did, and Hashem will take away and he'll take away these plagues. So the Psukim describe how they fashion a bunch of golden images of mice, because that was one of the things that had been ravaging their land, and a bunch of images of golden swellings of various types that they had also suffered on their bodies. And they placed those all in a box and sent it together on the wagon with the Oren, and from then on that box was kept next to the Oren. As you mentioned before, the Gemara, the Bavli and Baba Basra mentions that according to Rabbi Yehuda, that the Sefer Torah that Moshe wrote wouldn't fit inside the Oren. Then there was a shelf outside the Oren they would put it on. After that, there was this box over there, and they placed it on top of the box. You're wondering, you're making a face, like, why would that box belong next to the Oren? I guess one...
Like a Zohar or something.
It's not of a Zohar per se, because they didn't make them for worship. They made them as a gift to Hashem. But I guess one thing you could think of is that, really, when you think about it, that's the first time in history that an entire Goyish nation showed respect to Hashem. The Mitzrayim, for example, didn't. They gave the Jewish, they lent, quote unquote, the Jewish people gold and silver and whatnot before they left, but they didn't actually do anything to show that they respect Hashem's power. All the nations that fought against the Jewish people and were defeated over and over during the time of the Shoftim, we never find that. Here we find the Plishtim for the first time are doing that. So maybe that's something special that deserves to be in the Kodesh HaKadoshim.
Also, maybe Nineveh with Jaina.
That was later. That was later anyway, but yeah. Besides, there's nothing tangible that you can put in there. Okay, anyway. So fine. So all of those things were hidden together with the Oren. Mi Gonzai, who is it that hid away the Oren? So again, according to Rabbi Eliezer before, who said that the Oren was captured and taken to Bavel, then obviously this whole thing doesn't begin. But according to the other opinions that we said that was hidden under the Kodesh HaKadoshim, under the Lishkas Dira Eitzim, who is it that hid it? And the answer is Yoshiyahu, who was one of the last kings of Yehuda. He became king at 8 years old, and he ruled for 31 years, and he was killed in battle by Parah Nechoi 22 years before the Churban. So what happened? In the 18th year of his reign, so he was 26 years old, this is 36 years before the Churban, he gave orders that the Beis Mikdash should be renovated, that by that time it had been about 200 odd years since the last big renovation of the Beis Mikdash. It was badly in need of repair. So when they were doing the renovations, then they found a Sefer Torah, and there's different opinions what was so special about the Sefer Torah. The Pasuk describes everybody was very taken aback by it. They brought it to Yeshayahu, and Yeshayahu was also very impressed by it, and decided we have to make a massive tshuva movement in the whole Eretz Yisrael. There's different opinions among Mefarshim what was so special about that Sefer Torah. Some say that Bechlal, they may not have seen very many Sifrei Torah. Menashe and Amon, the two kings before Yoshiyahu, had destroyed as many Sifrei Torah as they could get their hands on. So it's very possible that at least Yoshiyahu himself had grown up never seeing a Sefer Torah. Others say it's very hard to say that. The fact is, we Jewish people have always learned and kept the Torah. You always had a core of faithful Jews who kept the Torah. So they give different explanations. Another possibility is that it was the original Sefer Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu had written. So in that case, that's something special. Another possibility is that it may have been taka regular Sefer Torah, but in particular, as the Gemara is going to say over here, it was rolled to a particular place in the Teuchacha, and therefore that's Simona Milsa. The very fact that they found it open, rolled to that place, is something unusual. Usually, by the way, the Bavli in Bava Basra describes the Sefer Torah that was kept in or next to the Oren was usually rolled near the beginning. The Gemara describes over there, there wouldn't have been room to roll it all the way. It had only one Eitz Chaim, unlike our Sefer Torah have two. But it wouldn't have been rolled all the way to the beginning of Bereshit, because then there wouldn't have been room for it in the Aron. The Gemara calculates, so it was rolled to like Parshas Noach or something. It was rolled like a little bit further in from the beginning, so that there'd be enough room for it in the Aron. The point is, here he found it, instead rolled to Parshas Kisavai. Anyway. So what happened? Kivin Shira Shakosib Boy, when he saw that in the Sefer Torah that was written, the Pasik Yoylach Hashem Oischabes Malkha Shaturkum Alakha in the Torchacha in Parshat Kisavai, Hashem is going to take you and your king that you set up over yourselves into Golos. So he realized that means there's a Simon Minashamayim that the Golos is coming very soon. And he didn't want that the Oren should fall into the hands of the Goyim. Omad Vagonzai. So therefore he went ahead and had it hidden away. Shenema, as we find Pesukim in Divrei Yomim. He said to the Levim who understand Torah among all the Jewish people, like the ones especially among the Jewish people who understand the Torah best, Hakdoshim LaHashem, who being Levim are holy to Hashem, he tells them, Tnu es Aron HaKodesh ba'bayis ha'shabonah Shlomo ben David Melech Yisrael. Place the Aron HaKodesh in the house that Shlomo ben David Melech Yisrael built. Now, what do you mean place the Aron in the house? It had been there already for 400 years. So there are Mephoshim who say on a pashtus level that maybe, for example, when Menashe put an idol in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, maybe he took out the Aron, so now Yoshio has to tell them to put it back, but the Gemara doesn't like that explanation, and it's understanding that he's telling them to put it in the underground vault that Shlomo had built all those years before. He continues telling them, Ein lachem masa b'kosef, you no longer after this have the mitzvah of carrying the kalim of the Beis HaMikdash on your shoulders, as you did back in the Midbar. After Yivdu as Hashem b'goyim, and now you're going to serve Hashem and the Jewish people by hiding away the Aron. Meaning, what's this Ein lachem masa b'kosef? Omer lahem, because Yeshayahu is telling them, Im goyle imachem l'bavol, you should know, if the Aron goes with you and golos to Bavol, shuv ein echoz l'mekoymei, it's never going to return to its place. So therefore, we don't want that. Therefore, we have to hide it away here in the Beis HaMikdash, underneath the Beis HaMikdash. What does that mean? Why is it not going to return? Various Mephoshim talk about a few different possibilities. First of all, it could mean that the Goyim would never allow them to return it. As it is, you have, finally, when Kodesh proclaimed that they can build the second Beis HaMikdash, and later on, when Daryavish reconfirmed that permission 18 years later, they allowed them to take back the Kalim of the Beis HaMikdash, but had the Aron been there, they never would have allowed that to go. So that's one point. Another point would be that you might not be, the Jewish people might not be on the level at that point to be able to be on the level of Kedusha, to be able to carry the Aron anymore. After all, we find that people who were unsuitable, who touched the Aron, died, like Uzzah, for example. And a third possibility is that, maybe the mitzvah of carrying it won't apply anymore. And a fourth possibility is maybe the Aron will lose its Kedusha if it leaves Eretz Yisrael and goes to Bavel. So whatever, for any or all of those reasons, Yeshayahu is telling them, the Aron can't go to Bavel, and therefore we don't want it to fall into the hands of whichever army it's going to be. That, as the Pasuk says, Yoylech Hashem Oischa, therefore we have to hide it away under the Beis HaMikdash. Since we mentioned as I mentioned the other day, the Rebbe talks about Nesicha, that the Rambam brings this point, and the Rambam learns that it was in fact hidden under the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and the point of that Lahalocha, the Rambam doesn't bring things in Mishnah Torah that are not in Yad HaChazaka, that are not needed Lahalocha, the point is that establishes, therefore, that the second Beis HaMikdash is still considered to have the Kedusha of a Beis HaMikdash, insofar as, for example, that you can bring Korbanos there, and that you can't bring Korbanos anyplace else, etc. All of that depends on the point of the Aron being still there in its location under the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and the Rebbe develops the idea in that Sicha that basically there's two places that are valid for the Aron, one in the Kodesh HaKadoshim and one underneath it.
According to the Girsa, that the Aron is not there.
According to the Girsa, the Aron is not there. He might say, in fact, that maybe the second Beis HaMikdash had to. Bechlau, you have a machloikas. What you have a machloikas between the Rambam and the Ramban, which also the Rebbe has Sichas on the subject. What is the basic function of the Beis HaMikdash? Is it basically a place to bring korbanos, or is it basically a place for the Shekhinah to rest? If you say it's basically a place to bring korbanos, then it doesn't matter so much whether the Aron is there or not. If you say that if it's mainly a place for Ashuras HaShekhinah, then the Aron has to be there. So that would depend. Rabbi Eliezer, who says that the Oren was taken to Bavel, he might well say, fine, but the Bais HaMikdash doesn't necessarily require the Oren to be there in order for it to have the definition of the Bais HaMikdash. In any case, when the third Bais HaMikdash is built, Shibonim Herav Yamenu, then the Bais HaMikdash, then the Oren will be back there in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. An interesting point, by the way, that Mephoshim deal with is why, for example, let's say the menorah we find was stolen by the Greeks when they took over the Bais HaMikdash, and then they made a new one after when the Hashmonaim took back over. Similarly, the other kelim were all replaced. Why don't they just make a new Oren for the second Bais HaMikdash? And there's a couple of answers. One of them being that, first of all, the Oren is not the Oren without the Luchos. So if they don't have the Luchos, then it doesn't really mean much anyway. But aside from that, there's the idea that the Oren itself has a special degree of Kedusha that couldn't be replicated afterwards. Besides, yeah, so, and also an interesting point is the Chlal. How did the when you have, so like this, any replacement, for example, let's say they replaced the menorah. Now we said the Shemen HaMishcha was hidden away. So how did they make that new menorah when the Hashmonai made a new menorah? How did it become a menorah that's valid lahalacha to be used in the Bais HaMikdash? So the Gemara explains in a couple of places that only the original kelim that were made in Moshe Rabbeinu's times had to be anointed with Shemen HaMishcha. After that, avodasin lechanachton. After that, whenever you use a keli for the avoda, it automatically becomes kodesh by virtue of that. Well, that works for the menorah. For example, you light the menorah the first time, then it becomes kodesh. Same thing with any other keli in the Bais HaMikdash. The Oren, there's no avodah you do with it. All it is it contains the luchos. So there's no avodah that you could say avodasim machanachton, and that would also be a reason. Achronim give these various reasons and others why there couldn't be an Oren, why there couldn't be a replacement Oren in the second Bais HaMikdash.
What about the
sprinkling of blood? That's done. In front of the Oren, between the Badim or whatever, the Oren itself is not actually used for it. You know, yeah.
One does not negate the other.
Right. Okay. Speaking of the Shemen HaMishcha, the Gemara says, Toni Rabbi Yehuda Bar Eloi. Now, before this, the Gemara brings over here, and the Bavli also brings it in Hodias and a couple of other places, about how was the Shemen HaMishcha made in the first place. So one opinion is that they're now the psukim described. You have to take a bunch of various spices of different kinds, and then you take a shemen zayis hin, which is approximately a gallon of olive oil. So now the question is, and then the idea is that you make it the shemen hamishcha, you make it into perfumed oil using those spices. So first the Gemara brings an opinion. That they boiled the spices in, they ground up the spices and boiled them in the oil. But then the objection is that, what do you mean? The oil, that's not enough oil to even soak the spices, much less boil them. So in the end, so he gives a different explanation, and then the Gemara ends up saying, "Tani Rabbi Yehuda Bar Eloi, Shemen HaMishcha, so Asha'asa Moshe Bamidbar, Maisin Nisim Hoyba Mitchilosev Ad Soifo." Really, the whole thing was one big series of Nisim from beginning to end. The whole thing was only 12 lugin, which again is around a gallon or a little more. Shanam of a shemen zayis hin, a hin is 12 lugin. And im losuch ba'yse ikrim lohaya maspik, it wouldn't even be enough to soak all of the spices. When you look at the amounts of spices that it says in the psukim, 500 shekels weight of this one and 250 of that one and so forth, it comes out, it's a much bigger volume even than this 12 lug of oil. So lohaya maspik, it wouldn't be enough for that even. Now you have to think, you're boiling up the oil together with the spices. Necessarily, some of it would evaporate by the fire. But eitzim boilim, some of it would be absorbed by the spices themselves. The yoda boiler and the vat that you're cooking it all up in would absorb some of it. And yet, not only it stayed the entire 12 lugin, omi menu nimshach mishkan v'chol kelav. With it, they were able to anoint the mishkan and all of its vessels. Va'koyinim v'malochim, and the koyinim gdolim of future generations. And the kings, whenever David himself, and then whenever there was a machlokas, as the Gemara goes on to discuss in detail, and the Gemara continues, and the whole 12 lugin b'derech nes still continued to exist and will continue to exist lo'olam vayed.
They're
always going to be 12 lugim, no matter how much of it they use. So this is all derech nes. So therefore, so don't worry about that there wasn't enough on the face of it. There's not enough oil to cook up the ikrin in. Don't worry, there wasn't enough oil to use up and still have 12 lugim left, and yet there's a nes. There's a sikha, I think, where the Rebbe talks about the underlying machlokas. Is it once we say it had to be mais and nisim, can we say everything was done mais and nisim, or does the Torah require that at least you do as much as possible b'derech hateva, and whatever can't will be done b'derech nes? The Rambam, in fact, paskens according to the other opinion. The Rambam paskens according to the opinion, I think it's Rabbi Yossi, who says what they did is they soaked the ikrim, they soaked all these spices in water until the water absorbed all of the aroma of the spices. Then they boiled up the oil together with the water, and then when the water evaporates, then you have left the essence of the spices in the oil. So that way, at least it doesn't require mice and nissim for that part. But yeah. Okay. Going back now to the luchos, ketzed hoyu haluchos ksuvim. How were the Dibris written on the Luchos? So Rav Chananya ben Gamliel oimer chamisha aluach zeh v'chamisha aluach zeh. So Rav Chananya ben Gamliel says that there were five, exactly as we usually picture them, five written on one luach and five on the other. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, v'yichtevem ashnei luach zavonim, the Pasuk says he wrote them on two tablets of stone, implying if there's 10 Dibris and there's two tablets, heyal zeh v'heyal zeh, then it means there's five on each, the way that we usually see them depicted on Poroichasin and on other depictions like that. On the other hand, Rabbanan Amri asora aluach zeh v'asora aluach zeh. The Chum say all 10 of them were written on one, and then they were rewritten on the other one. The Pasuk says, Hashem told you his bris, his covenant, which he commanded you to do, the 10 dvarim. And when it says the 10 dvarim, implies that they're all, and the Pasuk continues, he wrote them on two stones. So this opinion of the Rabbanan holds that it means, in other words, all 10 had to be written on each of the two luchos, not 5 and 5, but 10 and 10. We'll talk about afterwards when once we go through this piece what would be the reasons for these different opinions. Rav Shim Ben Yochai says that there were 20 on one luach and 20 on the other, meaning that the Aseres HaDibros were written twice on each luach and then written again on the other one. As the Pasuk says, he wrote them on the two tablets of stone. So since, in other words, since it says, now we know already that there were two luchos, so it means, just like vayichtivein, means that he wrote them on one stone, so they're on one tablet, the other one also means, so since you have another pasuk that describes that he wrote them on two stone luchos, then it means it was written twice, all 10 dibros were written twice on each one. What's the significance? We'll talk about at the end.
No, how did they... say that it's quite because at vayichtevem because it's a loshen rabin
because he's saying because it says vayichtevem al shnei luchos so why does it need to say vayichtevem and al shnei luchos so it's repetitious vayichtevem it could have said vayichtoiv al shnei luchos so that gives us a reason to say that it was written multiple times on each dibros on each luach. So Reb Simoy Omer Mem al Luach Zeh or Mem al Luach Zeh. Reb Simoy says it was written 40 times, 40 dibros on one luach and 40 on the other. So on each luach, it was written 8 times. Shenema mizeh umizeh heim ksubim, as the pasuk says, they were written from this side and from that side, which elsewhere the Gemara explains means that the letters could be seen. They went all the way straight through, as the Gemara tells us, that the Bavli tells us in Shabbos, the Yerushalmi tells us in Megillah that the letters penetrated all the way through from side to side, and Reb Simoy understands that to mean that they were actually not just now the Bavli, when it tells about it in Shabbos, explains that yes, the letters went all the way through, and Bederach Nes, they could be read forward on the other side, meaning in other words, you'd see, for example, an Aleph, it wouldn't be a backwards Aleph on the other side, it would be a straight Aleph. However, the Gemara says over there, the words themselves would read backwards on the other side. The Gemara gives an example of there. If you had the word, let's say, for example, if you had the word Nevuv, Nun Vez, Vav Vez, then reading on the other side, you would have Bez, Vav Bez, Nun. But our Reb Simoy over here in the Gemara is saying, at least according to one way of understanding him, that no, what it means is they were actually, you could read it, Bederach Nes, the proper direction, no matter which side you looked at. So not only it went all the way through, but Bederach Nes, it would actually read the right way.
Wasn't it only the first luchos?
We're talking primarily the first luchos. And by the way, one of the many opinions that explains why the Dibros had to be repeated, we'll talk about it soon, but one of the many opinions about it is, we know there are two versions of the Dibros, one in Yisrael and one in Vaschanan. So one explanation is, in fact, that when we're saying over here that the Dibros were written multiple times, it would mean because they had to incorporate both versions. With that said, there are other Mephoshim who learn that the ones in Yisrael were written on the first luchos, and the ones in Rosh Hashanah were written on the second luchos. But yeah, primarily we're talking about, I mean, both sets of luchos, it was Michtav Elikim Hu. So but Pashtus, all the psukim that we're talking about over here, all the psukim that we're darshaning from are in connection with the first luchos. So it's possible that they mean only these things by the first luchos, but given that they were michtav alekim hu, by yichtav aleluchos kamichtav arishon, then maybe it would also apply to the second luchos as well. The truth is, there is a lot of different. There is a lot of discussion. There's an interesting discussion also that Advaz, among others, brings an interesting point. The Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us that at one point the script that's used for writing Kisvei Kodesh, according to one opinion, was changed. They used to use what's called Ksav Ivri or Ksav Libruna. You find that, for example, on coins from the time of the second Beis Mikdash and inscriptions from the time of the first Beis Mikdash, and then you have Ksav Ashuri, the square letters that we're familiar with. So there's an interest. So the Gemara brings an opinion in Sanhedrin that there was a period of time when they were writing in Ksav Ivri, and then in Ezra's times they changed to Ksav Ashuri. So there's an interesting idea, I think, that Advaz says that maybe the first luchos were written in Ksav Ivri, were written in Ksav Ashuri, and the second luchos, which were on a lower level, were written in Ksav Ivri. In other words, because at that point, they were on a lower level after the Chet Egel.
But according to history, the Ksav Ivri is first...
Well, according to history, never mind. I mean, the fact is, according to that opinion, we would say that Ksav Ashuri was used only for Kisvei Kodesh, where we don't have any Kisvei Kodesh from that time, and then. So there's a lot...
With the sapphire? On the sapphire?
Yeah, it was written on the sapphire, yeah.
That's the most expensive stone, right?
That's, yeah. So anyway, so again, sort of Simoi says, Mema Luach Zeh, Mema Luach Zeh. 40 on each luach, shenema mizeo mizehem ksuvim, meaning, as he says, they were written from this side or the other, tetruga, which means that they were fourfold. They were tetruga, and in Greek, tetra means four, so tetruga would mean four times. So we'll continue tomorrow with it, Be'ez Hashem, but there are a lot of different possibilities that you can see over here. Akosef himself has a diagram over here to illustrate what it means when he says that they were written two times on each luach, according to the B'shim Ben Yochai. The old 10 Dibros were written twice on each luach. So you have, he learns that it was written one time right side up and the other one upside down. So in other words, whichever way you turn the luach, whether you hold it right side up or whether you turn it upside down, you'd have a set of Dibros written in the proper direction. Then there are Mephoshim who learn that it means that according to him, they were written on both sides. And again, it was Bederach Nes that you can see through from side to side. And then the opinion that says, Reb Simoi, who says they were written 40 times, would say it was written actually on the sides as well, not only on the front and back, but also on the sides, so that you have 10 on each one. And then you have Bederach Nes. In other words, it was carved one time through, and Bederach Nes, it could be read straight through on all four sides. So we'll talk about tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem, more about the various opinions in that and the significance of them. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach Ge'ola, Yud Aleph Tishrei. So today is B'Shem Hashem, Gotz Nomen. And now you have the pasuk that says about that Hashem is going to sprinkle us with Parah Adoma water, as we said over and over in Yom Kippur Davening, was Zarakti Aleichem Mayim Tehurim Tehautim, that Hashem himself will sprinkle us with pure water. So we see in that the greatness of the Jewish people. You have the Mishnah at the end of Yuma, Ashreichem Yisrael, before whom do we become pure? Who is the one who purifies you? Avichem Shebashamayim. And then the Rebbe continues, this Diyuk HaLoshon, Lifnei Me'atim Metarim. The word Lifnei also means in front of, ahead of, like Lifnei Havaya Tetoru, which means Apichzidus, that we go to a level even higher than Shem Havaya on Yom Kippur. And then that Tara is even higher than that. In a similar vein, that's why it's to explain that in Kesa Shemtiv, why the day after Yom Kippur is called Gotz Nomen, because Yom Kippur is already Lifnei Havaya, we're already higher than Shem Havaya, so therefore the day after that, was in today's Hayom Yom as well, is only called Gotz Nomen, as if like you can't even say any specific name, because already we're beyond that. Some halachas of Sukkah. So when it comes to building the walls of the sukkah, one thing is they have to not move around in the wind. So one thing is when you have the canvas sukkahs where the walls do move in the wind, there's quite a bit of discussion among poskim whether such a thing is valid, given that basically they do stay in place and they just flap around a little bit or not. So one thing is one piece of advice they often give for that purpose is take ropes and tie them around between the poles of the sukkah within three tfachim of each other. Do a few rounds of that below, and that way you have at least 10 tfachim of height made up of those ropes with less than three tfachim between them. And that way it's lovered, and that way for sure you're covered, even if the rest of the wall all the way up is made out of canvas and flaps. 10 tefachim is about 30 inches.